From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat. This is Idaho Matters. Many bird species around the world are struggling, trying to adapt to a world that's changing around them as humans encroach on their homes. The West is seeing this happen with the Columbia sharp-tailed grouse, where birds can only be found on 5% of the habitat where they once roamed. Meanwhile, up in the Arctic, gyr falcons are getting more bird flu as warmer weather brings more insects and disease in Alaska and Greenland. So are birds like these able to adapt to change? And how can we predict if they'll be resilient enough to survive? Stephanie Galla has two possible answers to these questions, DNA and a kinder approach to research. She's an assistant professor in avian biology in the Department of Biological Sciences, and she's the primary investigator of the Conservation Genetics Lab at Boise State. And she joins us now. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Samantha. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so what is the Conservation Genetics Lab at Boise State? What does it do?
Yeah, we are a group of researchers here at Boise State University, and we use DNA to better understand birds in a changing world. And just like you mentioned, many bird species around the world are experiencing decline. And if we want to create proactive measures for management, we really need to understand their story. And the story of birds and the story of life is written into DNA. So, like I mentioned before, our lab group uses many different genetic and genomic tools to better understand the story of diversity of birds and how they may be, adapting to a changing world.
Wow. Okay, talk about the Columbia sharp-tailed grouse. You've done a lot of research on this bird. Describe it. What does it look like?
Oh my gosh. These are one of my favorite birds that are out there. So Columbian sharp-tailed grouse, this is a subspecies of sharp-tailed grouse. You could imagine a bird that's a little bit smaller than a chicken, but these are just some of the coolest birds, I'd say, in the state of Idaho. It's a lekking species, meaning that all the males will congregate in an area and they'll display and have access to females. And how they display is they dance. So the genus that they're in, Tympanucus, it actually translates to the drummer.
Oh.
So what they'll do is they will stomp their feet on the ground.
Nice.
They will put their wings out wide. They'll rattle their tail and they'll inflate these air sacs on the sides of their necks that are bright purple. And they have these eye combs. Think of like eyebrows that are bright yellow. So an incredibly charismatic bird that is found here in Idaho and one of the best dancers that you'll see.
Wow. Okay. I love it. Dancing grouse. This is awesome. But they're declining. I read somewhere that in places like in Washington, they used to have hundreds of thousands of them, but then there are fewer than 1,000 birds left in some of these spots. Is that true?
That's right. Yeah. This subspecies has experienced significant decline. Amongst all of the subspecies of sharp-tailed grouse, this one is experiencing the most decline out of all of them. Here in Idaho, we're really blessed. We have about 30,000 birds left. So really the stronghold in the lower 48 is in our state. We have a really precious resource here that we can manage, and we can make sure that they stick around for as long as they can.
Okay, so you started researching grouse, grouse DNA. Tell us about DNA. What do you do, and how does DNA help the grouse, or how finding out about DNA helped the grouse?
Yeah, that's a great question. So DNA, it's a really great way for us to understand what diversity is left in different populations, especially those that have experienced decline. And if you think about a declining population, or maybe one that's experienced what we would call a bottleneck, gets really small, really quick, it may have reduced genetic diversity.
Mm.
And this is really important because if you have reduced genetic diversity, you may have less diversity to respond to anything the world can throw at you. So if there's a new disease that pops up, do you have enough diversity in your population that some of those individuals will be able to make it? Or do you have climate change that occurs? Do you have diverse birds that are able to respond to a changing environment? So usually diversity is a really great proxy for the ability of a population to adapt. So we often use DNA to understand what diversity looks like, to identify populations that has lower diversity and maybe less resilient and in need of conservation prioritization in a changing world. That's one way that you could use it. There are many other ways that I can also dig into, but I'll see if that answered your question first.
No, that's perfect. That makes perfect sense. And I love it. The first thing that came to mind was bananas, because there's like one kind of banana, and if a disease hits the banana crop, we won't have any bananas. So
that's
you
exactly
need that
right.
diversity.
Yes.
Just, okay, I get it. So, and I'm sorry, some folks may be eating lunch right now, but you study grouse poop, right, to find the DNA?
We sure do. Yeah. Feces and poop is an amazing way for us to understand birds in a changing world. Within a single fecal pellet, we can understand the diversity of what birds are eating and how they're responding to changing habitats over time. We can also get a good idea of their gut microbiome, or all of the diversity of microbes that live in their gut. And the more that we understand species, the more we appreciate that these multi-species interactions, or the interactions between a bird and their diet and their gut microbes, might allow that bird a fitness advantage. So yeah, we can tell a lot by looking at feces. And it's really great because you don't need to catch a bird to find their poop. You can find it by looking at the areas where they congregate, or the areas where they sleep at night, their roosting spots. So that's what we do a little bit with fecals, especially for grouse. We're also getting into fecals for deer falcon as well.
Wow. And you built, I think, a diet database of what the birds eat in Idaho and Washington. And correct me, they eat like 110 kinds of plants. I don't know why, but I thought maybe grouse would just like snack on a couple things.
Yeah, that's a great question. It will depend on your grouse species. You have some grouse that are highly specialized, like greater sage grouse, also found in Idaho and Washington. Mm-hmm. In the wintertime, they will only eat sagebrush. But Columbian sharptail grouse are a little bit more diverse in their diets. They will eat a whole bunch of different plants throughout the year. But we're really interested in seeing what the diet looks like across space and time. So yeah, we are currently digging into their diet with fecal metabarcoding, and we've discovered roughly 120 different plant species across their range so far. So we're really excited to dig more into this approach and learn all of its caveats and get a better picture of diet for this rapidly declining subspecies of grouse.
Well, and that's got to be handy, because if we know what they eat, and we know they eat a lot, if some of the food goes away, then you know what's left or what to preserve.
Exactly. Yeah. If we know what populations are doing well and what they're eating and how that might compare to populations that aren't doing well, we can figure out whether or not food might be a contributor to population success or population decline. Or fitness of birds over time. So our first step is just characterizing the diet, because that hasn't been done in a very robust way in Columbian sharptail grouse. But once we have a handle on it, there's so many questions that can be asked with diet. And we're excited for our lab group to grow in that space over the next many years.
We're speaking with Stephanie Galla, an assistant professor in avian biology at Boise State, about her research into bird DNA. And you also studied, we mentioned this, deer falcons in the Arctic.
You got it.
Oh,
yeah.
Yay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you got it. There's many ways to pronounce deer falcon. So all of them are wonderful.
Tell me about these. What do they look like?
Yeah, deer falcon are the largest falcon in the world. So they're pretty big. They can also be variable in color. They can go from very dark birds to pure white. And they're found around the Arctic. They are circumpolar, so they're found at the very top of the world. And it's a pretty cool bird, because they can handle some really cold conditions. They don't migrate very much. So they just really stay at the very top.
Wow. Okay. And you found out they're getting more bird flu than they used to. Why is this changing?
Oh, this is a great, great point. So there are some populations that appear to be getting bird flu, those in Iceland in particular.
Wow.
Other places, they haven't detected it yet. But anecdotally, there is evidence that deer falcon are more susceptible just to disease in general. And one of the benefits of breeding so far north is that you're in a very cold place, and there's just fewer diseases commonly found in the high Arctic than, let's say, at the equator of the world. There's been some really cool studies that have come out that have shown that in avian immune genes, or the genes that help with immune defense in birds, they seem to be more diverse at the equator than up at the poles. So there's a lot of concern for species like gyrfalcon, where they don't really have anywhere else to go. They can't go farther north. They're really at the top of their range. And whether or not they're going to be resilient to new diseases that are getting closer and closer to the poles as time goes by with climate change.
Wow. And you've also done research in New Zealand?
I did.
Wow. That's a lot of different places.
Yes, I think that's the cool part about science. Science really connects you to a global community. And I was really fortunate to do my PhD in New Zealand studying the genetics of critically endangered New Zealand birds. And I'm happy to talk about that more too, because it's just New Zealand birds are very unique and they are very cool.
Wow. Okay. So before we get into New Zealand birds, can we talk about the Kindness in Science project? You're one of the co-founders. Tell me about this project.
This is a project that started when I was in Aotearoa, New Zealand, as a PhD student. And we felt like there was an opportunity to have some really thoughtful discussions about science culture, and what we bring to it, and how we can make sure that we keep as many diverse people at the science table as we can so that we can respond to really big challenges we're experiencing as a global community. So we started this Kindness in Science initiative to really define what is meant by kind culture in science, what is meant by collaborative culture in science, what is meant to have as many diverse voices at the table in science as we can. So we started that initiative, and it really started around defining what we mean by kindness in science, with creating cultures where you have mutual respect, where you are prioritizing diversity and maintaining diversity of people in science over space and time, and how that might be a little bit different from science systems, where maybe we have single individuals that are prioritized more than a group. So hopefully that answers your question a little bit more.
No, that's perfect. And you mentioned the New Zealand birds, some of which that are in trouble. Give us just an idea of a few.
So in New Zealand, many species of bird are experiencing significant decline. And New Zealand is an island nation found in the South Pacific. There are no native land mammals to New Zealand, but they've been introduced as people have discovered this landmass over the last 1,000 years. So the birds there are very naive to land mammals. Today, I'd say the biggest predators in New Zealand are rats, cats, stoats, and possums. And a lot of the birds there are just naive. They don't know how to respond to these novel predators. A lot of the work that we did in New Zealand was focusing around three different species. We had the kaki, or the black stilt. There are less than 200 birds left. But in 1983, there were only 23 individuals. So it's really was on the brink of extinction. Another species I worked with is Kakariki karaka, which is the orange-fronted parakeet. Twice it was considered to be extinct in the wild before being rediscovered. And they don't have a great idea of the exact number of Kakariki karaka left, but somewhere around 300 individuals. So these birds are really on the brink.
Wow. Okay, so I want to jump back to Idaho. Grouse, you're talking about birds in New Zealand that are very few. I mean, very few left. But grouse are not federally threatened or endangered yet. So why focus on them? I get, you want to focus on species where there's only 200 left, but grouse aren't technically that far in trouble. So why do we look at them?
I think that the wonderful thing about working with these grouse is, first off, they have very important cultural significance to the state of Idaho. They have a rich hunting legacy here. They're important to people for that reason, but also because they're so charismatic. And they are currently experiencing that really steep decline. But we have an opportunity here to step in and actually make a difference. Make a difference so that we don't end up with just a few hundred left. If there are tens of thousands of them here in Idaho, we have an opportunity to characterize their diversity, understand it better, and work with conservation practitioners so that we can actually create conservation strategies that keep them from becoming critically endangered. So I'd say that's my favorite reason for working with these species. They're not in the extinction vortex yet. They're not so small that we can't do something to make a difference.
And I guess my last question is, how does studying these birds in three very different parts of the world, how does that help bring not only conservation together, but people together?
Absolutely. I'd say like there's a really famous poet out there, Drew Landman, and he once said that birds are the thread that stitches the world together. They stitches the world together. They give us a really great sense of wonder and connection and home. And the great part about studying DNA is that every bird has it, no matter where in the world you are. So we can take lessons learned from other countries, from other systems. We could apply it here locally in Idaho to make best practice in management for these bird species, to co-develop it. And we can really learn from species all around the world using those same genetic approaches. So there's a lot of benefits to working together. And the more we come together as a global community with these different approaches, the better we can be equipped to address these big challenges and biodiversity loss that we're seeing around the world.
Wow. We've been speaking with Stephanie Gallis. She's an assistant professor in avian biology in the Department of Biological Sciences, and she's the primary investigator of the Conservation Genetics Lab at Boise State. We've been talking about her research into bird DNA. Stephanie, this has been great. Thank you so much.
It's been wonderful being here. Thank you, Samantha.
Thanks for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Samantha Wright. We'll see you tomorrow.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.